It's been. I'm Rod Hill.
Are you ready?
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to my favorite day of the week, First Amendment Friday. We got a lot to talk about here in the Pacific Northwest, including what is our X poll today. Should taxpayers have a right to know what kind of paychecks the government is offering its workers before the deal is done and the ink is dry? But before I jump into that, I want to alert you to something that's going on right now on the West Coast of America. In Los Angeles, the mayor of that city has announced that she is signing an executive order so that all city departments will oppose any efforts to arrest illegal aliens in Los Angeles. I mean, this is about as crazy as it gets. And I'll have more to say about it a bit later on. But Karen Bass, you know, the woman who did such a terrific job in responding to those fires in Pacific Palisades by going off to Africa. The woman who is now opposing the federal government's ability to enforce the law in America's second largest city. This is absolutely insane. If you wanted to know, if you happen to be a Democrat, this may hurt your feelings, but I'm going to suggest to you the entire Democrat Party or anybody who follows these jokers has gone absolutely nuts. When the second biggest city in America says that it will do everything it can to stop the federal government from enforcing federal laws in the second biggest city in America, you know that the Democrats have gone absolutely bughouse crazy. It is absolutely nuts. And I'm waiting to see what other West Coast cities, including Seattle and Portland and the other liberal sanctuaries for illegals, are they going to come out and do the same kind of thing? Are they going to say, yeah, if Karen Bass is doing it, why, whatever crazy thing she does, we're going to follow. We're going to stand up and we're going to oppose the federal government coming in and trying to enforce the law. It is that nuts. But welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. And welcome to the one day a week that we set aside just to recognize and encourage you to exercise your First Amendment freedoms. And it's easy to do. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And as is always true, every day of the week, naysayers go to the head of the line. And maybe there are some naysayers out there who say, yeah, Karen Bass is right. I mean, let's have a citywide effort to go to war against the federal government's enforcement of the law and in favor of the criminal illegal aliens who have occupied your city. I mean, if you want to go back for maybe a historic example, I mean, we've all heard of Al Capone, and Al Capone kind of ran the city of Chicago. Imagine if the city of Chicago had said why those untouchables are coming in from the FBI and they're trying to arrest Capone and they're trying to interrupt his criminal enterprises. And we are instructing every city department to oppose the efforts of the federal government to come in and enforce the law against Al Capone. I mean, after all, Al and his buddies, they're just a bunch of criminals. And it's the job of city government to defend the criminals to the detriment of the people who actually live in a city. If that makes sense to you, I'd love to hear the naysayer call, and so would everybody else who is listening. But let me get to this issue, and this is one that should bother you. If you pay your taxes and you expect government services, you know that the government has to employ people. And I understand there are plenty of people out there who work for the state, they work for the county, they work for the city government, and they deserve a paycheck. And of course, you have to negotiate how much pay do they get. Now, who knows when they're in the middle of cutting a deal about what kind of raise public employees get? Well, the government knows what's being offered. The union and its members know what they're being offered. Do you know the only people who are cut out of that equation? That is the people who are actually paying the bill and either receiving or allegedly receiving the services. I mean, think about ODOT right now, and I'm going to get more into ODOT a bit later. But the Oregon Department of Transportation finds out that it's not going to get a giant new pile of cash to replace all the cash that they already waste right now. And what did they do? I would swear that the folks at ODOT sat down and they said, let's do the things that will hurt the public the most. And also hurt a bunch of average workers as well. Did they say, well, if we're short of cash, we're going to take a bunch of people who wear suits and ties and show up at that big building down in the state capitol? No, we're not going to fire the white collar workers. We're going to go out and fire the blue collar snowplow driver. We're going to fire the people who do the maintenance on the highways, the ones who fill potholes. We're going to fire those people first. Now, does that make any sense? It does if you think in a very sick and twisted way, and apparently ODOT is as twisted as they come. You say, if they're not going to give us more money, if even a Democrat supermajority in both the House and Senate in Salem, if they are not willing to deliver us the cash, $1.5 billion per year for the next 10 years that we have demanded, then we are going to change the way this place operates to hurt the customers the most. Now imagine if any private sector company did that. If a private sector manager said, well, if the boss is not going to give me the big increase in my budget that I want, I'm going to make sure that customers who walk into whatever store it happens to be, could be Schwab, could be Fred Meyer, could be Safeway, could be QFC, we're going to make sure the customers feel this. We're not going to mop the floors. We're not going to clean things up. We are going to make the customers suffer because it's their fault. Now, if that's the way you approach things, I would suspect you don't have much of a career if you're working in the private sector. In government, this seems to be the way they operate. But here's where it got even worse. As Jason Mercier of the Mountain States Legal Foundation points out, a ruling from the Washington State Supreme Court, and it was an 8-1 ruling, has given the official blessing to keeping all those negotiations about the paychecks that public workers get, to keep them secret. Well, not secret from everyone. The people in government know what the secret is. The people on the paycheck end, the unions and their workers, they know what is being offered. And oftentimes you'll see somebody from TV news stand there and say, well, workers aren't very happy with what they've been offered. And if you're one of those members of the public who says, well, what are they being offered? How much of an increase are they getting? Oh, I'm sorry. You're not allowed to know. The unions can know, their workers can know, the government can know, they're spending your money, but the people who actually write the checks and pay the taxes to pay that bill, you're not allowed to know. And now the Washington State Supreme Court has said, anytime there's one of those negotiations about public employee paychecks, the public is to be kept in the dark. By failing to uphold the clear intent of Washington's robust public records law, tell you what, you're going to see more labor unrest, not less, because offers and counteroffers that add up to billions of dollars, you're not going to know what they are. They've actually said the public can be kept in the dark, the people who actually pay the bill. Now, anybody who thinks that's right, absolutely not. And if you say, well, I work in government, I don't want people to know what we're being offered or what we turn down. Well, if you don't want to know what you're being, you know, that to be known publicly, go to work in the private sector. The minute you go to work in the public sector, what you get paid is a matter of public decision making. And keeping the voters and the taxpayers in the dark until the deal is done and the ink is dry, that is just dead wrong. Back in just a moment. Answer our X poll. Should taxpayers have a right to know what kind of paychecks government offers its workers, the ones you're going to pay? The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network on First Amendment Friday. If the winter weather is taken...
Gun control explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense? sense.
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, Senator Ron Wyden ought to be best what he best be careful what he asks for. I guess it's fool around and find out is Wyden's approach to this. Wyden has invited the Trump administration's border czar to join him at a town hall next month in Portland. Tom Homan promises to double and triple down on sanctuary cities like Portland, where local law enforcement has been ordered not to cooperate with the enforcement of America's immigration laws. Homan visits next month, and I can tell you, in interviews and confrontations, Homan holds his own. Look up the videos if you don't believe me. Maybe it's the fact that Wyden makes his home in New York City, 2,500 miles away from the state that he claims to represent, and that's what leaves him so out of touch. He claims that ICE has deported, in Wyden's words, key members of our community, essential workers and entrepreneurs. He's talking about illegal aliens. This is the same guy who would tell you that illegals sheltered by sanctuary cities only do those scut work jobs that Americans refuse to do. So which one is it? Scut work job workers or essential key members of the community? Senator Wyden. Meanwhile, Wyden's fellow senator, Jeff Merkley, went the opposite way, demanding that Homan stay in D.C., bizarrely suggesting that a visit from one of America's top law enforcement officials would only lead to trouble in River City. I've talked to Homan for years, and I know what he's likely to tell these two boobs. He intends to enforce the law and safeguard communities. Anybody want to argue that's a bad idea? For some context, illegals make up maybe 4% of Oregon's population, but they represent 14% of the convicted killers locked up in Oregon prisons and 18% of the rapists. Let Senator Wyden take a swing at explaining how allowing an invasion of millions of illegal aliens serves the citizens that the senator claims to represent. Glad to have you with me on a First Amendment Friday. Your calls welcome. I'll get to them in just a moment. But first, our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. John writes in, Lars, longtime listener, thanks for what you do. My wife and I are political opposites. I need info and I don't know where to find it. Can you help me? I have repeatedly told my wife that illegals are helping suck Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security dry. By deporting them, it'll actually ease the financial strain on those programs. Her comeback to me is working illegals, in fact, pay taxes and pay into Social Security. I doubt this, believing that most illegals don't have legal jobs. Can you help me with any stats or tell me where to find them? Thanks, signed John. Well, I got to tell you, John, people often say illegal aliens pay their taxes. You have no way of knowing that. As you suggest, many of them work cash jobs. Many of them work jobs where you avoid paying the payroll taxes, and that's what feeds Medicare and Social Security. As for Medicaid, they are sucking that system dry because too many of the liberal states, including California, Oregon, and Washington, have offered up Medicaid for illegal aliens. They pay for it through a process that, if you did it, would actually be considered insurance fraud, but the states have been getting away with it. Only now the Trump administration is cracking down. As for Social Security, do you know what the illegal alien fans in this country want? The ones who just love illegal aliens all day long? They're going to suggest at some point, well, they've been here too long. You can't force them to leave. And they, while they haven't been paying into the system, or we have no way of knowing if they have, you have to qualify them for Social Security. It's a process called totalization. It's been done before. They will help to bleed Social Security dry, and it ain't going to be there when Americans get to it. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, I promised you that I would do this when it was appropriate. I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to some White House aides. These are aides to Donald Trump who apparently engaged in using insider info. It turns out that right before Donald Trump announced his tariffs on April the 2nd, the one that kept had the stock market falling off the edge of a cliff. Well, it turns out some of his top advisors sold off more than $1 million in stocks, apparently in anticipation of that drop. They were Sergio Gore and Dan Scavino. Dan Scavino is the White House chief of staff. He's got one of the most high-profile jobs in the White House. Both of the men sold off their stock in Trump Media and Technology Group, the company that runs Trump's Truth Social platform. Gore sold 15 to 50,000 in stock. Scavino sold off between 1 million and 5 million in stock on April 1st. The reason that's a range of numbers, they're not required to disclose the actual exact number. They're only required to disclose a range of numbers. So with Gore, 15 to 50,000. With Scavino, somewhere between $1 million and $5 million. Before he went to work at the White House, Scavino got a lot of stock because he worked for Truth Social. And then he sold it off just at the right moment before the stock market kind of crashed for a couple of days. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more, is brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They've done it for me, and it is beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. So Brian Ripp writes in, Lars, typical Tina Kotek. She lays people off at ODOT who actually do the work and not the people sitting behind a desk in Salem. To your calls now. It's a pleasure to be with you on First Amendment Friday. 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Matt. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
Well, Lars, I want to talk about that 20-year-old punk that dropped those two firemen. This guy, if they catch him, and I hope they have now, they should take, because you were talking about this a few days ago, they should take that guy and throw the book at him, lock him up for life.
Well, he's dead.
Oh, he's dead? How did he die?
He got shot, and I don't remember whether they determined that it was self-inflicted or whether he was shot by one of the law enforcement when they were shooting back at him. So the book has at least been thrown at him already, although he may have thrown it at himself.
He did, and the law enforcement got him probably.
Well, we don't know. I mean, because I'll tell you something. An awful lot of people engage in those kind of violent acts, Matt. They are, at the end of the day, cowards. And let me tell you how I back that up. When you see mass shootings, they usually end one of two ways. Either the shooter, the killer, the murderer, shoots himself, or they put their gun down and they sit and quietly wait for law enforcement to take them into custody. And by not presenting any kind of threat, law enforcement has no ability or authority to shoot them. An example of that
Why do they sit down and quietly wait for law enforcement to take him into custody?
Because they're cowards. They don't want to die.
Oh.
Yeah, and so, for example, James Holmes in Aurora, Colorado, who walked into that movie theater and slaughtered people with no reason behind it whatsoever, when he was done killing people, he went out to his car with the door open, sat down, put his gun down, and waited for law enforcement. That is a guy who doesn't want to die. And he knows that if he's holding that gun, he will give an officer both the authority and the legal ability to shoot him dead. By putting his gun down and just sitting and waiting, he decided, I'm going to simply be put in the loony bin. And that's what ends up happening to a lot of them. The rest of them shoot themselves in the head, and that's the coward's way out, too.
The Lars Larson Show.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails in a moment. But first, I want to talk about logging. Now, you hear about logging on this show a lot. My dad was a forest ranger, so I know just a tiny bit about it. But I wanted to talk to Dennis Teitzel, who's with the Bureau of Land Management, because, Mr. Teitzel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because I get regular press releases from BLM, Bureau of Land Management, not the other bunch, because you were talking about selling a lot of boards, millions of board feet of timber. And what always frustrates me is I want to know how much more could we be doing, because I'd rather see the forests cut and replanted than see them burn down. So this latest announcement is that you're going to, you've sold about 19 million board feet of timber across about 700 acres for about $5.5 million. Congratulations on that. Should we be doing more of that? And are we missing an opportunity to both generate jobs, tax revenue, and prosperity and avoid fires? Are we missing an opportunity by not doing more of that?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Lars. You know, opportunities, we take them when they show up. We, we take advantage of them. The thing is, you know, we have what we call our resource management plan, the RMP, that was done in 2016. It's been tried in court. It's been upheld. And it sets what our maximum allowable timber production is. For Western Oregon, that is 350 million board feet. The 19 million you're talking about is one month of one sales out of our district. We typically, like this year, we're doing 132 million board feet total, our average. It usually sits a little bit higher, somewhere around 140 to 155 million board feet. We do between $45 to $50 million of timber sales a year. So, you know, it's not, it's not should we. It's, you know, are we taking advantage of the opportunities that we have?
Okay, just so I don't get the numbers wrong, Mr. Teitzel, 350 million is what you're allowed to log, and you're logging about a third of that?
No. 350 million is statewide. The 150 million or so number is what we in the Northwest Oregon District log, and we manage we manage just a portion of the ONC land. There's a total of 2.4 million acres of ONC land.
Yep,
we manage
Oregon and California.
700,000 of those acres.
Well, let me ask you this. You're in timber management, so what would be the I always tell my audience about sustained yield. As I said, I'm not a forester, but I understand sustained yield is the amount you could effectively cut forever because the trees grow as fast as you're cutting them down over a period of time. What would be sustained yield if you could do it under the law? How many million or billion board feet could you cut from the BLM lands if you did it at sustained yield?
So right now, our analysis and our resource management plan has determined that 350 million board feet is the sustained yield quantity that we can produce.
Now, you were careful to qualify that because that's what the plan says you're allowed. How much wood mass grows in the forests you manage during a given year?
You know, I honestly do not know that number. That's, you know, there's a lot of variables that come in there. It'd be a really, you know, hard number to throw, you know, just to throw out there, you know, variables of, you know, how much rain did we get that year? What's the weather like that year? You know, what other factors come into play there? So, you know, so that really is a hard number. As I said, well, you know, the plan that's been approved and upheld in court gives us the number of 350 million board feet per year for Western Oregon.
And is it fair to say that the amount of wood mass that grows in those forests has to be more than 350 to make it sustained yield? But it could be a billion board feet. It could be 2 billion board feet. But it's almost certainly a number bigger than 350.
You know, that would be speculation on my part to say anything, you know, to say anything about that. I'm like you, I'm not a forester, per se. There's a lot of smarter people than you and I that are out there looking, trying to figure those things out.
And so does the BLM within your region, the entire region that's controlled by BLM in Oregon and Washington, does it get to that 350 million number every year, or does it cut short of that?
Well, we cut what's mandated, through the administration. We get a target and a target to meet a production number. This year, our production number, 250 million board feet is what we're what we were given for this year, FY 25. And, as we get those numbers and requirements from the administration, that's what we make adjustments to produce.
Because that means you're cutting 100 million board feet short of what you're allowed to cut.
And what the sustained yield is allowed under the RMP, yes.
Yeah, because I keep hearing that every time they cut a million board feet of lumber, that makes about 8 jobs in the private sector, cutting trees, hauling trees, milling trees, turning it into lumber, all the rest of that. That would mean that a million board feet is 8 jobs, which means if you're cutting 100 million short, you're missing out on what could be, 8,000 jobs or 800 jobs? 800 jobs.
Yeah, you can do the math there. You know, again, it's about what are we mandated to produce. There's, again, like I said, there's people who are a lot smarter than I am who, take a look at, the economy, take a look at the capacity, and then come out and give us, what they want us to produce, and we strive to hit those targets.
Under the new Trump administration, is there a message from the White House to say, let's get cutting a whole lot more timber?
So, we have received executive orders. They have highlighted the timber industry as being vital to national security. As being, an industry of importance, so we have gotten that message. What we're waiting on is, what is that number, that hard number that they want us to hit moving forward? We are taking a look, to be prepared for what we're given, and so we can make those adjustments.
Yeah, but no general message to cut more, because that was the message I thought I heard from the Trump administration was we need both the Forest Service and the BLM to be cutting more timber.
It's one thing to say cut more timber. It's another thing to give us, what is that amount you want us to hit?
Well, how about the whole $350 million you're allowed to cut?
If we're given that number, we will achieve it.
Okay. And is there any way to find out how much the possible sustained yield would be? Because I'm really curious. If 350 is safe to cut and you'll be able to cut that number forever, would 600 be safe to cut?
I do not know that answer, Lars.
Okay. Fair enough. Mr. Teitel, I appreciate you taking the time.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Lars. You have a good day.
And you as well. That is BLM Northwest Oregon District Manager Dennis Teitel from the Bureau of Land Management, not from Black Lives Matter. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. You'll find a daily poll question every day at Lars Larson Show on X and on my website at LarsLarson.com. And...
They talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. On First Amendment Friday, we serve the Pacific Northwest region, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon, with honestly provocative talk. And on Friday, every Friday, we celebrate your First Amendment rights. I want to point this out. There's an economist by the name of Joe Courtwright who does some great writing about some of the serious issues of the Northwest. And he points to the deep-seated dysfunction of Oregon's Department of Transportation. So, a couple of weeks ago, the legislature wrapped up and said, no, we are not going to give ODOT another $15 billion over the next 10 years, $1.5 billion per year. And he points out, instead of owning up to this fiscal reality, ODOT is savaging its own workers, falsely claiming it has no option but to lay off hundreds of workers, even though revenues in its budget that started July 1 is going to be higher in the coming biennium than in the past. I think they're doing something else, though, that Joe does not point out, and that is they're saying, let's make this as painful as we possibly can for citizens. So, as you've heard already, ODOT says, oh, you know what? We're having to cut people. There may not be people to plow the roads this winter. There may not be people to patch holes or do routine maintenance. Ask them how many white-collar workers down at the big headquarters building of ODOT got laid off and how many of them were blue-collar workers who actually do the jobs. To your calls. Let's go first to Gary. Hey, Gary, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, speaking of causing pain to the taxpayers.
Yeah.
Last week, I did my elderly neighbor a favor. She doesn't drive any longer, but she asked me to take her truck through DEQ and get it re-registered. Four trips I had to make to the various DEQs. The first one out to Clackamas, where traffic was literally backed up to 205. And I thought it was a wreck somewhere. The closer I got, I realized the backup was because of the DEQ testing.
Unbelievable.
So I go out to 33rd. I'll try it out there, driving all the way out there. Traffic backed up around the block. I haven't got the time for this. I went back again several days later, waited in that line 1 hour, got right to the testing thing, and their card reader went down. So unless I had cash or, you know, a check, which I didn't, I had her card, they said, well, you'll have to come back, which I did the next day, and the vehicle failed. Then I drove out to Clackamas. Right after that, the vehicle passed.
Yep.
And it occurs to me, we're causing more pollution doing this than we could possibly save.
I think you're right. And by the way, Gary, I'd point out Washington State used to do vehicle emissions testing for the same reason. They said in certain counties, think King County for the most part, maybe Spokane as well, they did testing for 38 years and they quit on January 1, 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago. And why did they quit? Because the air quality is better today, number one. But number two, because modern cars don't need, nor would they benefit from the kind of, you know, they used to go to the DEQ test. They would test you, say you fail. You drive a block away, and there was usually a guy with an umbrella set up, and he would adjust your car so it would pass. And then you'd come back, and he would adjust it so it would run right. That was the game they're playing. And I've asked the state of Oregon, why don't you end this? And you know what their answer literally is to me? They've said, well, but what will all our DEQ test workers do for a job? And I said, I don't care. The buggy whip makers back in the day lost their jobs when Henry Ford made automobiles. And all the buggy whip makers and the ones who made, horse-drawn carriages had to go find other jobs. But the state of Oregon, is using this as a make-work job.
It is. I actually asked the person there, I said, do you ever ask yourself if you're causing more pollution? She said, no, I don't want to ask myself because I know the answer to that. She said, well, what would I do for a job? And I said, well, it's not up to the government to provide jobs. They're to provide a service to the taxpayers. This is not a service.
And by the way, if she wants another job, Gary, do you suppose her talents would transfer over to an automotive repair shop? Maybe. Or if she does more of the desk work or the clerical work, she can go to one of those jobs. But they love their PERS pensions. You're right. It's a great opportunity. It ought to stop very, very soon. Let's go to George in Squim. Hey, George, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
How you doing, Lars? Say, I wish I had known that you were going to have the EPA or the BLM guy from Oregon before I called. Well, I have two issues. Number one, the Democrats created the problem that's occurring with the immigration issue because they've made it so easy for people to come into this country and have incentivized building illegal marijuana production areas and greenhouses because the state California regulations for the legal pot growers is so onerous and so expensive that the illegal ones who do not even bother with EPA restrictions as far as dumping pesticides and doing other ecological damage they have a straight line connection to Mexico.
Yep.
Where they hire illegals.
Oh, no, they don't hire them, George, in many cases. California just saw an ICE raid this week. They raided a legal pot farm, and what'd they find? Children being forced to work out there in the weed plants. I kid you not. It's First Amendment Friday. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
They look like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to posit something to you. Imagine if you were a Democrat. I know that for many of us that would be very difficult to imagine being that deranged. But imagine you're a Democrat politician, and you have to go to your constituents and say to them, by the way, I'm going to spend a lot of money on people who are not citizens. I'm going to spend a lot of money on funding abortion and the biggest abortion provider in America. And I'm going to have to take that money from some of the services that would otherwise be provided to you, my constituents. But I'm going to do it because I think it's the right thing to do. Now, I have a tough time imagining any Democrat being honest enough to actually communicate to their constituents and say, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend money on people who have absolutely no right to get it, either killing babies because the Congress has decided to defund Planned Parenthood, the biggest baby killing bunch in America. Oh, and by the way, we're going to pay for Medicaid. So all the illegal aliens who aren't supposed to be here anyway are going to get health care, and it's going to come at your expense. I thought we'd talk about that with my buddy Ari Hoffman. He holds down the fort in the afternoons after I've warmed everybody up on our affiliate station in Seattle. That's KVI. Hey, Ari, welcome back.
Glad to be here, buddy. Thanks for having me.
Do you think we could ever get the governor of Washington State or members of Congress or city councilors or county commissioners to actually explain we're going to spend money on people who have absolutely no right to get it, and it's going to come at your expense, my dear constituents?
No, for them, they just have the same talking points they have all the time. Oh, the women, oh, the children, oh, the poor, or the helpless, or whatever the case it is. They don't actually look at the fact that a lot of these illegal aliens are flat-out criminals. Forget the fact that they came here illegally. Look at just ICE Seattle. Look at their social media accounts on the people they're deporting. Murderers, rapists, child pornographers. And yet, these are the people that the Democrats keep defending. The craziest example of this is what happened in California yesterday. You have a pot farm where federal agents were raiding the thing because there were juvenile child laborers working at a pot farm, and the left is getting mad at the federal agents for saving these kids who were working at a pot farm. And let's remember, pot is still federally illegal.
And it's not only federally illegal, but even in the states where they've legalized the consumption and the recreational use, I don't believe in it, but that's what the, you know, legislatures or the citizens voting have decided to do. Fine. That's what you've done. But it's still illegal for children to have access to pot. And you're right. They were working kids in the pot fields. And I'm not even sure. I mean, number one, I don't think kids that age were allowed to do that kind of work, although I've got a different view on whether or not kids should be allowed to do jobs in agriculture. I think they should. But should we be employing illegal alien children to do it when they won't do it for Americans? I mean, you know, for people who worry, Ari, about how America looks to the rest of the world, because they're constantly saying, oh, Donald Trump is humiliating us to the world. What do you suppose the rest of the world thinks when they hear, yep, Americans won't let their own kids work in agriculture, but they're happy to have illegal alien children worked in agriculture? Do you think that looks right to anybody?
No, of course not. Let's remember how we looked to the world during the Biden administration. We were weak. We were worthless. Nobody was taking us seriously. People were starting to go and start advocating to Russia, to China, to other countries rather than the United States. The value of the dollar was falling not just because of inflation, but because people were doing business with China and Russia, and they were doing those deals in their currency versus the U.S. dollar, which devalues the dollar. Now we have a strong American. People are negotiating with President Trump. We're getting better deals than we've ever had before. And I think right now a lot of people are saying America's back and not to be trifled with. The only ones who think otherwise are the Democrats in our own country. Because the truth is they never liked this country and they want to see the downfall of this country.
Yeah, and it's funny. I was going to give you one piece. You're probably aware of it already, but in the last couple of days, we've seen news that Jerome Powell may actually leave the Federal Reserve. I wish they'd just get rid of the Federal Reserve altogether, but getting Powell to leave so that he can stop tying the economy up in knots by refusing to reduce mortgage rates. And I actually saw a letter that was sent by the head of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are the big federal mortgage agencies, and he's applauding the decision of Jerome Powell to leave. So there is some good news happening out there. But back to this issue of benefits, the idea that the White House just came out today and said, look, this new policy is going to cut off illegal aliens from getting $40 billion in public assistance. And you've got states like Oregon and Washington and California say, no, we'll cheat our own citizens to make sure the illegals lose nothing.
Yeah, it's crazy, and we don't have the money for that here in Washington. I mean, think about Governor Bob Ferguson. This is a guy who said he's going to backfill the money that Planned Parenthood just lost because of the Big Beautiful Bill, rightfully so, by the way.
Yep.
He says he's going to backfill it with money here from Washington. Where's he going to get that from, given the fact that they just passed the largest tax increase in Washington state history, and even by doing that, they found they are still over $700 million short in the upcoming budget because they can't do math right. So where are they going to get the money from? Plus, Washington state taxpayers are already spending over $59 million on Planned Parenthood. How much more money do you need to spend on this insanity? And then, at the same time, who are they cutting benefits for? They're cutting benefits for these children, for example, who are born to drug-addicted parents, so the babies are born drug-addicted, and the Democrats don't want them removed from the home, and now they're cutting funding for the facilities that treat these poor, helpless children that were born into bad circumstances. I mean, the Democrats want to help out illegal immigrants, but they don't want to help the babies that are products of their own failures.
And by the way, I know that the folks who are fans of Planned Parenthood, which, by the way, grew out of Margaret Sanger's, genocidal ideas, because Margaret Sanger founded the organization, and the idea was to kill mentally retarded people, as they called them in the day, and black people, because she wanted to eliminate undesirable people. And Hitler literally actually learned from Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. But they'll say, but they do other kinds of work as well. You know what 70% of their business is? Birth control. And Ari, I got to tell you something. Birth control has never been better in technology than it is today. It has never been cheaper than it is today. It has never been more available than it is today. So if you believe, oh, I don't believe in the abortion part of Planned Parenthood, but they all do all this other important work you can get from your own doctor, and if you're poor, on Medicaid, and then you can go down to Walgreens or CVS or wherever you want to go and buy your own damn birth control. Why in the world should the taxpayers be funding that?
Well, Lars, I got an idea for you. Let's look at these other very important things they fund. So I saw Planned Parenthood's logo all over those flyers for the No Kings protest / riots.
Uh-huh.
That's the important work they're doing. So now our taxpayer dollars have to go to funding riots against our own government? So is that the important work that Planned Parenthood says that they do? Instigating riots, instigating protests? Yes, I'm sure that's very, very helpful. I'm so glad we fund that.
Yeah, we give a bunch of money to NGOs with a stated purpose. Whatever the good thing is, you think it is. And then they take the money and they spend it on political activism. I don't think taxpayers should pay for that. That's Ari Hoffman. He has his own talk show on our Seattle affiliate. That's KBI. Ari, thanks so much. I appreciate the time. In a moment, we'll talk about how L.A. has announced a full-fledged effort to oppose any enforcement of federal law in America's second biggest city. That's coming up next. it comes...
Ever wonder what a vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
I am here today to sign an executive directive, and I just want to point out the irony for a minute, that there is a need for me to have an executive directive to help our city understand how to protect itself from our federal government. Just let that sink in for a minute.
Yeah, it didn't even take me a minute. That is L.A. Mayor Karen Bass asking you, imagine this. Imagine the second biggest city in the United States of America has decided that it is going to fight against the federal government's enforcing of federal law in a state or a city that is still inside the United States of America. You know what, Mayor Bass? I don't even have to think for 1 minute about that. I understand that. Instead, people should be asking, and I would imagine a lot of Los Angelinos are asking right now, why is our city opposing the federal government in enforcing federal law at all? And is it chaotic, as she's described it, unlawful and chaotic, because of that opposition? I think that's exactly what's happening. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a First Amendment Friday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, we put naysayers right to the head of the line. I'd love to see if somebody is willing, as a naysayer, to argue that the mayor of Los Angeles, or any mayor in America, is right to say the federal government is enforcing federal law in our city and we intend to stop it. Is anybody crazy enough to say, well, that's wrong? And in fact, here's what's really crazy, because in every city in America, you've got federal laws that are sometimes broken and people are taken into custody. If somebody is taken into custody, for example, for bank embezzlement, which is typically a federal crime, there may be state statutes about embezzlement, but if it's a federally regulated facility, like most national banks are, then it's going to be a federal crime. Do you think that Los Angeles or Portland or Seattle or any other city in America has any problem saying, yeah, you're breaking federal law there, we're going to arrest you, and then we're going to immediately hand you over to the federal authorities where you're going to be charged and tried and probably convicted? I don't think any city would. In fact, I can think of at least a dozen different crimes. One of them would be kidnapping across state lines, the Mann Act. And you can imagine a government saying, or taking a person across state lines for immoral purposes. I think that's what the Mann Act says. And if you had a crime like that, you would want that person to be prosecuted federally. Los Angeles, Seattle, you know, Chicago, Philadelphia, they have no problem handing over suspects and those kinds of crimes to the federal authorities. But all of a sudden, when the federal authorities say, we want to enforce federal immigration law, and as we pointed out already, California has already seen a raid on a major marijuana farm, a legal marijuana farm, that was illegally using child labor. And what did that marijuana farm do? Like so many marijuana farms we've heard about in the last couple of years, they were giving huge amounts of cash to Democrats in that state. I mean, that's happened in so many states. The amount of corruption that is involved there is amazing. And I'm willing to bet that a lot of those farms that get raided, they're going to wonder, well, I sent Gavin Newsom my contribution. Isn't that enough to protect us against a raid? And yet that's exactly what Karen Bass is complaining about. She's complaining about federal law enforcement coming into her city and staging raids like they did earlier this week. Take a listen to her comment on that.
We've seen them in the general region. I'm sure many people saw Camarillo yesterday and what broke out there. We saw MacArthur Park earlier this week, which I think now, after all assessments, it is viewed as just a display of force.
Now, she's not exactly clear on what she means as a display of force. Every time law enforcement shows up to enforce a law, to some extent, that is a display of force. Except there was no force employed. I mean, I didn't see anybody wrestled to the ground. I didn't see anybody shot or tasered or anything else. But she apparently thinks enforcing the law is wrong, at least if it's a federal law. If it's a state law, well, as we've seen in the last few weeks in Los Angeles, an awful lot of local laws are simply violated with impunity, and LAPD doesn't do anything about it. And yet now she's saying she signed this executive order today, and she's directed every city department to develop what she calls preparedness plans for protecting illegals in LA from the federal government. She calls them our illegals in Los Angeles. In other words, you've got people who are criminals. In many cases, they are terrorists. In some cases, they are rapists and murderers and child molesters and human traffickers. And Karen Bass of Los Angeles is going to stand up against that. And these are the plans she talks about.
So the executive directive that I will be signing in a few minutes is to help the city family, to help the city workforce, to help the city departments and all of the general managers essentially develop preparedness plans that have specific protocols and that help city workers know how to address immigration officials should they approach a city department.
Now, I got to tell you something. I have a sneaking suspicion that Karen Bass may be doing a lot of this for her own benefit. Now, imagine this. This is the mayor who is off on a junket in Africa when part of her city caught fire, the Pacific Palisades fires. And when she came back, virtually everybody in America knew that Karen Bass's political career was over. She had been a member of Congress. She came back to Los Angeles after she lost that gig. She got the consolation prize to be mayor of Los Angeles. She's done a terrible job at that, and now it looks like she may end up with no job whatsoever. So maybe what she's trying to do, maybe she's hoping that if she interferes with federal law enforcement enough, that maybe Tom Homan and ICE and CBP will come in and arrest her and charge her with obstruction of justice, which I think is what she's doing right now. Because Tom Homan has made it clear that if city officials decide to do this, they may face federal charges. That would be just about the only thing I could think of that would actually save the political career of Karen Bass. So I hope they don't do it in this case. Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, thanks for the call from the Dalles. Thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call, Lars. We have a situation that I'm not sure about. I wanted to find out if you know more than I do about it.
We got about a minute, so we have to get right to it.
Okay, and we voted this last election about, we've been voting for 45 years here, same county. And they contacted about 10 to 14 days later and said that your vote didn't count because somebody didn't think that the signature matched. So you have to come down and do another whole re-registration of voting. And is that something that goes on? They said it was due to training.
It does. No, it does because, Mike, you know, you sign a signature card. A few years later, you cast a ballot. If they think it doesn't match, they do what's called ballot curing, where they want to make sure it was actually you that marked the ballot. I think that's a sensible thing to do. Now, I think Oregon and Washington have really screwed up voting systems and screwed up voter registrations that are populated by foreign nationals and people who shouldn't be voting at all. But do I agree with checking your signature? Absolutely. And if you're thinking they shouldn't check your signature, then just about anybody could vote your ballot, and I think you'd agree that would not be a good thing. It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland. At least someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Fridays. All calls are welcome and naysayers go to the head of the line as always at 866-HEY-LARS. I've been looking forward to talking to Tony Delgado, who's the CEO of Latino Wall Street. Tony, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
I understand you've been hanging out with candidates for the mayor of New York. Was that the communist candidate or the other folks that are running?
Unfortunately, the communists didn't want to meet with me. I was really looking forward to going to the grocery store and not having to pay for anything. But no, the candidate I was hanging out with is the current mayor of New York, Eric Adams.
Yeah, and there is a chance.
Who we're supporting.
Imagine this, Tony. What if we get to the point where a Democrat who's on the outs with his own party, the incumbent, could actually save America's biggest city from being run by a communist maniac like Mamdani?
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be the ultimate irony that the Democrats thought that they were going to call the shots, the party, right, the Democrat Party, the DNC, right? We call it the demon deep state DNC, and we thought that they were going to call the shots and say, hey, listen, just because you're criticizing Biden's open border and just because all these millions of migrants are being bussed into your city, you know, you can't say anything about it. You got to keep your mouth shut or else, right? So it's going to be a big middle finger to the establishment if he still prevails in spite of that.
And they tried to use lawfare on him. That's a whole discussion for another day. But I wanted to ask you about this because Brooke Rollins, the Secretary of Agriculture, came out and said there is going to be no amnesty. Now, help me translate this for my audience because I'm dead set against amnesty, have been for more than 30 years. I remember when George W. Bush said, I'll see you at the signing ceremony, planning to sign another amnesty, another disaster, and it never happened. So I don't even know why the trial balloon of amnesty was even floated, but where do we sit on that whole issue?
Well, I mean, listen, you know, the history of amnesty and this type of immigration reform and these various policies, I mean, it goes back to Reagan. That was one of Ronald Reagan's biggest achievements with the Hispanic community, but, you know, it does create a unique problem because if you give amnesty and you give people a pathway to citizenship, right? Amnesty is basically saying, hey, you crossed the border illegally, but, you know, you're going to get basically a pardon from the government. We're going to give a pardon to every single person who came across the border illegally, and we're going to put you right on a pathway to citizenship. And there's a lot of problems with that. There's issues with, well, then where does it start and where does it stop, right? If there's free amnesty, then why would anyone come across the border, come into this country the right way, right? Why wouldn't everyone just come across the border illegally and just claim asylum or amnesty the second they get here? The problem that we've had in reality is the past 4 years, the asylum process has actually been used under the Biden regime, right? So we had people who were coming across the border, and the second they get here, instead of saying, you know, I'm here for a better life, I'm here for the American dream, right? They were instantly claiming political asylum. And for your viewers who may not know, that's essentially saying my government wants to kill me, right? I'm a political refugee because if I stay in my home country, there's some communism or some socialism or some sort of dictator in my home country, and I'm a political prisoner, and I'll be killed, essentially, if I go back to my home country. So we had all these false asylum claims coming across the border, and that's because the Biden policy was to expedite and actually encourage people to do this. They made the app famously. They instructed Border Patrol, instead of turning people away at the border, they were instructed to immediately put these people on buses and in many cases, planes, paying for plane tickets and shipping them off to major cities, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, the good news is President Trump put an end to that, right? We've had historical low border crossings. It's almost down to zero at this point. Because, you know, the world was put on notice and they don't want to get sent to Alligator Alcatraz and they don't want to get sent to El Salvador. So just from that strong stance on policy, even without any legislation, President Trump's just being in office has pretty much brought the illegal border crossings to a stop. Now, when it comes to amnesty, right? Trump has made it very clear that he's not supporting amnesty. There's been multiple interviews where the press and the media has questioned him on this over the last few weeks since the first statement that he made. what he is looking to do is to create some sort of a common sense legislation and a work visa program for people that are here. Now, what's the difference between that and amnesty? Well, amnesty is a general pardon, and it basically says that your sins are all forgiven and now you can become a U.S. citizen. What a work visa program would do is something similar to kind of what he's already said. Hey, listen, we need people to come out of the shadows, first and foremost, and self-deport, and basically raise your hand and say, hey, listen, I'm here, I'm in this country, and, you know, my status is questionable, right? And then what that would allow is it would allow people to pay a fine, have some sort of a punishment, and then have some sort of a track so they can get back on track, start paying taxes and becoming somehow productive members of society. The issue that we've been having just in the economy is that ICE is looking to hit their quota, right? We had 10 million official border crossings over the last 4 years. Biden, the real number is probably closer to 20 million, right? Yep. And the problem is, well, where do you find these people? Where do you go? Where do you,
even on DACA, when Obama illegally created DACA, it wasn't a law, it wasn't even an executive order. And, you know, when he did it, I think it allowed up to 1.4 million. Only 600,000 even bothered to sign up for it because, the logic was, and if I don't do that, what are you going to do? You're not going to throw me out. So why should I bother to sign up for it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's a lot of fear and uncertainty, right? So I think, you know, it's obvious that the immigration system is broken and it's overburdened. I actually just had lunch with Mayor Eric Adams and a bunch of people from the Young Republicans down here in South Florida, and also a woman who became a citizen today. So she went and became a U.S. citizen this morning legally, and then came and had dinner with us, and we all clapped, and it was an amazing moment for her. So there is still a way to do it the right way, but I think we need reforms in place. I think we need more funding for the customs and the border agencies, and that doesn't all have to go towards deportations. That can also go towards administration to get people paying taxes, getting more visas issued, and getting people on, again, the right track.
But Tony, I'll be honest with you. I don't want to jump those people ahead of the process because you've got that problem you mentioned at the beginning, and I've talked about it before. If somebody spent 5 to 7 years to go through all the process, pay all the money, talk to the attorneys, and do it right, and then you say, well, this guy just jumped the border, but we're going to hand him a work visa, and he gets effectively the same thing you got. You just told that woman you had dinner or lunch with, you did it the stupid way. You did it the hard way. This guy got it the easy way. And she's going to say, well, then why did I bother to do the right thing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I completely agree. And that's why there's a piece of legislation right now that was put on my desk from an NGO that works in the immigration sector called the Yellow Card. And essentially what this would do is say, listen, you came here illegally, and because of that, you're never going to be eligible for citizenship.
And that would be one way to do it. That is Tony Delgado, who's CEO at Latino Wall Street. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Coming up, the folks living at Alligator Alcatraz aren't happy.
Message from Lars.
I'd like to apologize to anyone I've not offended yet. Please be patient. I'll get to you shortly.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program on First Amendment Friday. We serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. And this segment of the show comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Should a man go to jail for refusing to wear a mask in a government building? Now, just in case you checked your calendar and said, Lars, it's not 2020 or 2021. The pandemic is long over. Well, apparently wearing masks by government mandate is still very much an issue. So let me tell you about Tom Hazzello. Now, I'm guessing at the pronunciation, but he is an Island County man in Washington State. And why is he in trouble? He's looking at possible jail time. And why? Because on November 4th last year, just last year, say 8 months ago, at the Island County Elections Office, he was there to observe the ballot counting process involved in Washington State elections. And what did he do? Well, he went to the county elections office and he said, I'm not going to wear a mask. You know, one of those protective masks that don't actually protect you from much of anything. He's now looking at a year in jail. And why? He was charged with two crimes because of the dispute he got into with the county auditor, because the county auditor had imposed a mask mandate in the elections office. And why did they do that? Well, the county auditor is Sheila Kreider. And Sheila Kreider had testified in court. This guy is on trial right now, and he might get a year in jail. She had imposed a mask mandate. I don't know under what authority she did this, but she apparently thought she could do that because she said almost half of her staff had previously gotten sick with COVID-19, and she couldn't afford to have that happen again during an election. Kreider also testified that they were concerned about dangerous substances like fentanyl that had been found in ballots in other counties. Does anybody mind if I point out a couple of logical objections to all this? Number one, if you get COVID-19, we were always told, well, you get some immunity for some period of time. You're not going to get it again. Number two, and more importantly, masks don't protect against COVID-19. So she wants her staff and visitors to wear masks because they're going to be protected against the virus COVID-19. And then she says there's fentanyl. Now, how exactly is a cloth mask over your face going to protect you from stuff that, if inhaled, it might be a particle big enough to be caught by a mask? It might not be. But in this case, the jury took 2.5 hours to find Hazzello guilty of unauthorized access to a voting facility. That is a felony and criminal trespass and a gross misdemeanor. Hazzello had previously been charged with disorderly conduct. He tried to observe the ballot counting process and would not wear a mask. I'm curious. Let's go all the way back to the beginning and find out if the Island County Auditor actually has the legal authority to order people, citizens, who come to the elections office to tell them they have to wear a mask. Let's go to Lou in Linden, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Lou, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Yeah, I wanted you to remind your listeners that in 2004...
Now, you got to turn your radio down, Lou, or you're going to drive me nuts. You're going to go nuts,
oh, okay.
And the people listening are going to be... The producers do ask you to turn your radio off, but anyway, you were about to say.
Yeah, in 2004, as I'm sure you remember, we had a very close election for governor, and Dino Rossi won the first count. He won the second count.
Yep.
But King County, Seattle kept finding boxes of ballots that, you know, mysteriously show up. And so they, with each recount, Dino Rossi's count shrinks. So once that was over, Stephen Sharkansky sued King County to get the ballots so he could examine them for himself, which by law, King County was supposed to give up so we could make sure we have honest, fair elections. Well, King County stonewalled for 2 years and they didn't turn over until the courts commanded.
Yeah, I recall covering all this 20 years ago, but Lou, what is the new issue that's involved in that?
Well, most of your listeners don't know who Stephen Sharkansky is. I want you to interview him so we can get the details and we can show that mail-in ballots are a curse on us and our state. We'll never have an honest election again with mail-in ballots.
Oregon has had the same experience. But, Lou, I'll tell you what. When I look for proof, I usually look for more recent proof than 20 years ago. I mean, some of us mentioned the Dino Rossi, Christine Gregoire race. But I think the more powerful proof today is that all the things that were promised by vote by mail, that you're going to dramatically increase participation. It has not. That it's going to be cheaper. It is not. That it's going to be more accurate. It is not. I mean, we're now counting ballots days after the election. We're counting ballots 3 weeks before the election. Nobody's quite sure when you're going to get a result, although Donald Trump did get a result election night. But in most cases, there are places where they're going to be counting for weeks. Use those current pieces of data. And then the fact that Oregon found thousands of illegal aliens and foreign nationals who are registered to vote. Motor voter is part of the problem. Vote by mail because there is no chain of custody on that ballot. The ballot is sent out from the elections headquarters. Nobody knows where it goes. You think it goes to an address. You think the voter voted it. The voter theoretically sends it back in. Again, no chain of custody, and it arrives at the elections office. It is, well, even Jimmy Carter thought that it was a terrible system and prone to fraud. Let's use that proof. Lou, thanks very much.
The Lars Larson.
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
Hey, looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Think back 1 week ago to those horrific floods in Texas. I know we've had other floods since then in places like New Mexico and other states. But in Texas, you had flash floods that were almost unbelievable. Although when we began to check the record, it turns out that those kinds of floods had hit the Guadalupe River before. The state had seen incidents like that, 15 inches more or more of rain in a short number of hours. They'd seen them about 20 times in the last 100 years. So not completely unheard of, relatively rare. I mean, if you're going to have those events about every 5 years, that's not the rarest thing in the world. And yet there was tremendous loss of life, just absolutely horrific loss of life, especially children who died because they were at a Christian summer camp. So immediately the Democrats began to blame climate change, and at least a few have suggested that perhaps weather modification may have had something to do with it. I thought we'd talk about that with Bonner Cohen, who's a senior policy analyst at the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Hey, Bonner, welcome back on a Friday. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Lars.
Well, let's start with the climate change part of this, because it took the Democrats about 10 nanoseconds to decide this was a result of climate change and therefore, by extension, the fault of Donald Trump. What should we say to them?
Well, that reaction was about as predictable as it was inaccurate. As you pointed out at the outset, this area is known as Flash Flood Alley, and it's known that for a reason, because these things happen there. This is an arid part of the world, and this took place in the Texas Hill Country. Note the word hill. That means that when torrential rainfall, and this came from a tropical storm Barry, when you have torrential rainfall, the rain goes downhill. These are dusty hills underlaid by limestone. The water rushes into the Guadalupe River. It has happened before. 1987, 10 people drowned as a result of this. If you can fault anyone here, it has to be the local people, local officials who did not take a few simple measures that could and should have been taken. For instance, for decades, people have said, we need a system of sirens. What do you do if something like this happens, as it did a week ago, at 1 o'clock in the morning? Okay, a TV, nobody's going to have it on. Nobody's going to be looking at their smartphones. But sirens, a low-tech solution, a series of sirens, would have warned people of impending danger. And you can bet that those camp counselors would have gotten those girls out of bed and tried to get them to higher elevations. That could have saved lives. and would have been a practical step that could have been taken, rather than what some people are doing, blaming climate change when there was no change at all here. That's the climate that particular area has. And as far as the National Weather Service is concerned, they issued many warnings.
The warnings, so, and by the way, just because, Bonner, I've had the emails from people who said, well, they didn't warn until 1 in the morning. That's not true. They issued warnings early on Thursday morning. They issued more warnings
exactly
Thursday
right.
afternoon. Then the warnings
right.
stepped up at 1 o'clock and at 4 o'clock. But anybody who was paying attention to those warnings had at least 24 hours notice before the floodwaters actually arrived.
Yes, that's exactly right. And let's also not forget that, look, we have to deal with whatever Mother Nature serves up. The most catastrophic flood that ever took place in the United States occurred in 1889 in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, when you had torrential rainfall over a very short period of time. It overwhelmed a poorly constructed dam. 2,200 people lost their lives as a result of that. In 1927, we had floods in the Mississippi Delta. Over 500 people drowned, most of them in Louisiana. So we have seen such things happen before. I think the important thing is, don't try to turn the thing into a political story where you try to score points against your opponent. Ask yourselves, what could we have done to limit the damage of this? Sadly, in the political world in which we live now, that has been certainly absent from, well, shall we say, certain parties, and we all know why.
And by the way, Bonner, a couple of things, and I want to test this idea on you. There were about 750 girls at this one camp, Mystic, and there were 21, I believe, at that camp. A total of 36 children lost their lives. And you say, okay, 750 kids at the camp, 21 died. And apparently quite a number of them, maybe even a majority of them, came from one or two cabins, which tells me there were cabins within that property that were substantially more at risk. And there were cabins where the kids had, you know, they had a problem because there was a flood, but they were on safe higher ground. And I would almost think that if you ran a camp like that and you knew there had been floods in the area before, you'd say anytime we get flood warnings, we double up and, you know, twice as many kids stay in the high ground cabins. You know,
That's
we
right.
move
yeah.
them up
get
there.
Get the kids out of the low-lying cabins and get them to higher ground. Exactly.
Yeah. And that's it, because they did say at some of these camps, they're Christian, some of them are Christian camps for kids, they said, don't bring your cell phone. We want you to focus on what we're doing at the camp and not on keeping your nose up against a screen. But you're right about the sirens. For the life of me, I mean, there are lots of parts of America that have tornadoes, and they have tornado siren systems for
that's
the
exactly
reasons
right.
you cited. And to say, we know this is a risk, we're not going to take, it's like driving out of your driveway without a spare tire in the trunk. It doesn't make any sense.
Calls for sirens at that area go back decades. People say, well, that's going to cost a lot of money. Then you have the problem of maybe the boy crying wolf. If we turn on the sirens, the storm turns out not to be so bad. Look, the thing to do here was to have sirens in place. It would have alerted people and may have been able to save some lives.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, I don't think there's any physical way to fix this, because they said when you go through a long, hot, dry period, that ground bakes itself to the point where you pour water on it and it doesn't soak in. I mean,
yeah,
many
islands. Not porous at all, exactly.
And so it just scoots along the top, and they said that river literally went up 29 feet in elevation in about 2 hours, and most of that in 45 minutes. So there wasn't enough time, but I just kept thinking about all the things they could have done by saying, we know there are flood warnings. When there's a flood warning, the whole camp moves, you know, to the higher ground cabins. And they probably know, just like they now know in New Orleans, they're what they call X-zone houses. And they say, during Katrina, these houses didn't get flooded. You say, oh, okay, well, during the bad floods at Guadalupe, which cabins always get flooded and which cabins never get flooded? On those nights, you put all the kids in those cabins and you get them out of harm's way before the flood. Bonner, thank you very much. That's Bonner Cohen from CFAC, the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Back in a moment. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome. 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
This musical message to anyone who wants to indoctrinate our school children.
Hey, teacher, leave the kids alone.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. In a moment, I want to tell you about a story that probably reaches out to every corner of America, although the specific example comes out of the state of Massachusetts, because there are strikes there. And oftentimes the strikes of public employees involve teachers, and they always strike through the kids. And I think that's evil, but let me tell you those details in just a moment. First, I want to go to Tom, who saw our question about whether or not anybody should ever serve jail time because they went into a government office, and this is in the last 8 months, and they were told you will wear a mask or you are not allowed to be in this office. In this case, it was an elections office. Tom, do you think, well, Tom must have given up on that one because I heard him hang up. So I'll tell you what, we'll go on that another. But you can find our X poll, which concerns that very question. A man who goes in last November to monitor the election that is going on, and he decides that he wants to watch the ballots being counted. And then he is told that he's being charged with a crime simply because he walked into a government office and he was told to wear a mask. I think some of these government officials need to sit down and consider, do I actually have the authority to tell private citizens who come into a government office, which is for most intents and purposes a public place? It's a publicly owned building. It is there for the purpose. If it's the back shop at a police station or a fire station, that may be a bit off limits. But I'm talking about the places where you should be able to walk in as a member of the public and watch the process of counting votes, and the guy is faced with a year in jail. Well, in any case, let me tell you what's going on with these strikes, though, because this comes out of Massachusetts. But if you ask yourself this, no matter where you live in America, there is likely to be a place that has seen a teacher's strike. And when teachers go on strike, in many cases, they don't have the right to strike legally. Teachers' strikes are illegal in 37 of the 50 states, 58 if you're an Obama voter. But 37 of the 50 states, it is not legal for teachers to go on strike. Do they go on strike anyway? Absolutely, they do. And when they strike, they always strike during the school year. I have covered a lot of teacher strikes. I have never in my life covered a teacher strike that actually happened during the summer. And why? Because teachers get the summer off and they want to enjoy their time off. So they strike during the school year. So in other words, you have public schools in America that are already failing kids. Most of the kids, half the kids who go to public schools in America do not make the minimum marks when it comes to math, reading, writing, and other subjects. So they're already failing the kids. And then the teachers say, we want more money, and we are demanding more money, and if you don't give it to us, we are going on strike, and your kids are going to end up getting less education than they do already. You know what? When I saw this story, I thought this should be happening everywhere. Parents in Massachusetts are suing the local teachers' union leaders for the harm they've done by going on strike. Now, this is about a strike that happened last year, 2024, in the state of Massachusetts. Massachusetts has a law that says no public employee or employee organization shall engage in a strike. Now, what often happens is that even if it's illegal for the teachers to go on strike, gutless cowards in public office, including governors, mayors, school boards, school superintendents, they chicken out when it comes to actually holding the teachers to the letter of the law. I think they ought to, because in most cases, teachers who go on strike during the school year and deny your kids a public education that you have already paid for, And in America, we're approaching $20,000 per year per child in public school. A lot higher in big cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York, but not much lower anywhere else. The average is in the high teens. So imagine knowing when my child goes to school for about 180 days every year, I am paying and my fellow taxpayers are paying more than $15,000 per year per student. Are you getting your money's worth? You're not. And then when the teachers go on strike and they go on strike illegally, you know what usually happens at the end of the strike? They come back, they have a new contract, they get the raise they wanted, and oftentimes they still get paid for the days that they skipped out on during the strike. So a group of parents got together and they said, we're going to hire a lawyer and we are going to go to court and sue the teachers union. Because I would put it this way, if it's illegal to go on strike and a number of people gather together and conspire to violate that law to the detriment of the kids, that's a conspiracy. And I would love to see union leaders charged with conspiracy. But if the local law enforcement authorities, the DA or the prosecutor, are not willing to do that, at the very least, the court should say, you've conspired together, you've damaged these kids by denying them education, you've damaged the taxpayers by taking their money and not actually doing the job that you contracted to do, and you've violated the law. I would love to see this happen. The court has now granted the school district's request and ordered the union to stop the strike. This was during the strike last November. On November 15th, the union filed a motion with the court to say it didn't even have the money to pay the fines that were being imposed on them. They knew that their actions were illegal. So imagine a union that says, we're going to organize the strike, we're going to hurt the kids, we're going to hurt the taxpayers, and when we get fined by the courts, we're going to plead poverty and say, we can't afford to pay these fines that you want us to pay. Now, in that case, I don't think the parents have any choice. And in fact, I wish that the school leadership would actually get behind these things. But oftentimes you've got people on school boards. It'd be a question you should ask if somebody comes to you in the next year and a half before the November election next year. If you ask them, if you're running for school board, what's your position on teacher strikes? And if you're in one of those 37 states where teacher strikes are illegal, you ask that person who wants to be on the school board, what's your position on teacher strikes? Are they illegal? Yes. Will you actually hold the unions and their members to the letter of the law? And if you won't, well, then you're just not going to get my vote. Let's go to Tom. Tom, you're a naysayer. What do you and I disagree about?
Yes, Lars, I heard the introduction you had given before we got disconnected. And my problem is just based on these facts with the guy with the mask. And that is, once the police arrived and asked him to leave, if he wouldn't leave, that's when they arrested him. So I think his fight with the auditor should have been on a different day at a different venue. But, you know, once the...
You mean on a day other than an election day?
Well, that does make it difficult.
Yeah, it does make it difficult because it's a one-time opportunity. And once the opportunity is over, they say, come back in a week. You can come back without a mask. How much... If he's there to monitor the election...
No, I meant, you know, maybe go after her, sue the state or sue her, the city or
months, years, but I doesn't do you any good that day.
Right.
Do you think any elections, think any elections auditor has the authority on her own to order people who come into a public office to wear a mask?
Well, he just said it worked, and I would say no. She did offer, from what I've seen on TV, you know, you can go over here and look then, and he didn't want to do that.
No, he wanted to see when they were counting the ballots because too many times citizens have been shut out of watching
that process. The Lars Larson Show.
People always
always ask Lars if he wants to run for public office, like president.
Do you know how much power I'd have to give up to be president?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about tariffs, but I want to talk about the positive side of tariffs, because for a long, long time, before the advent of the income tax just over 100 years ago, the American government was financed with tariffs, and there are a lot of us who'd like to get back to that day. Now, whether we could fully get back to paying for all of what the federal government spends, and boy, do they know how to spend, it would take a lot. But this year, it appears we could end the year at $200 billion in tariffs or more income coming into the government. Now, that could have a bad effect, because I've suggested to people, the minute you give the federal government more money, it's like giving a 10-year-old kid another $10 bill. You know what's going to happen to it. It's going to disappear faster than you can imagine. So I've invited Vance Ginn on. He's the former chief economist at the Office of Management and Budget, and he's now at Ginn Economics. Hey, Vance, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
Did anybody think, really, that we were going to be able to get this much income into the U.S. government? And did anybody, all those folks who were running around saying, well, if you put tariffs on, inflation is going to go out of sight right away? And, of course, that didn't happen, and the money from tariffs does appear to be coming in. I think the current, is the current number $130 billion has already come in?
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it's up over the last couple of years, because even during the Biden administration, they kept a lot of the tariffs in place that the Trump administration had put during the first term. So a lot of those haven't been the increases in tariffs that have been put in place of the 10% across the board during this term. It's really the accumulation of past ones. It's just that we're importing a lot more as well. So it's a combination of these factors. Because, you know, Lars, a lot of these new tariffs haven't went into effect, whether they be higher or lower, because they've either been paused and turned off and then back on. But still, we're looking to get, like you said, about $200 billion worth of tariffs come in this year, no matter how they come in. That's the additional revenue to the government.
Well, and in fact, the big, beautiful bill, which could have been a lot smaller, but not under current political circumstances, is promising over the next 10 years a $1.5 trillion in spending restraint. So the federal government spending $1.5 trillion less over the next decade than it would have. Is it possible that if we're getting $200 billion a year in tariffs over the next 10 years, we'll take in more money and gain more money for the federal treasury than even the big, beautiful bill will cut down government spending?
It's possible. And, you know, that $1.5 trillion in savings, of course, that's D.C. talk for less spending than otherwise. Spending still goes up, even if you rein in Medicaid the way they did for eligibility criteria, and those who are illegals, you know, can't be on Medicaid. That will slow the growth, but we're still expecting about 3% per year growth in Medicaid. It's just slower than the 5 or 6% we would have had, which is good. And you add in the tax revenues coming in from tariffs. I mean, that could also help with any sort of deficit increases over time. But we also got to remember, too, that there's increases in national defense spending, increases in border security spending, and also some energy spending as well. That, you know, I'm still concerned that the debt really won't be brought down much over this period of the next decade. And really, you know, Lars, I've been trying to make the case that instead of looking at decades to decades, no one knows what the economy is going to be over the next decade.
No.
We really should start doing it like states do, like families do. Look at year to year, and over the next year or two, even under the best of circumstances under OBBB, we're still probably going to have a $500 billion increase in the deficit just in the next year or two. So those are what's, you know, still some concerning things moving forward.
Is it possible to get government spending down so it at least equals income? Because we're way out of balance now, but it doesn't seem it would be that hard if the federal government actually took it if the Congress took it seriously. They're the ones who spend the money. Is it that hard to take a look at a government as gargantuan as the federal government is now and not say, hey, there's a whole lot of this we could do without? You know, and I know you're going to hear people saying, but what are these poor people going to do with jobs or for jobs? You say, I don't know, if they've got any skills and talents, they'll find a job easily in the private sector. And if they have no skills or talents, do you really want to have them on the federal payroll? It's not a make work job or non. I mean, you know, that's the thing. I hear government employees say, well, where am I going to find a job? But if you ask them, right. You know, why are you paid so much money? Why do you have a big fat pension? Well, you know, we bring all kinds of skills and talents to the federal government. But the minute you threaten to take their job, they say, I won't even be able to work at Dairy Queen if I have to leave my federal job. Well, then you're not worth the money we're paying you right now, are you?
Yeah, that's a great point there. You know, you're valued as much as what you're getting paid. You may not like what you're getting paid, so then you leave your job and find a different job elsewhere. But ultimately, that's what your value is. And, you know, federal workers used to get paid less than those on average in the private sector. And even if you compare the same amount of education to those in the federal government to the private sector, the federal government employees are getting paid more on average than those in the private sector. So it's more lucrative to go work for the government, meaning the taxpayer paying for it. And it's just nonsense. And to your point earlier, though, I do think that there are steps that we should be making in order to balance the budget as quickly as possible. I mean, we spend $7 trillion a year. We're only bringing in about $5 trillion. So even if you were able to include the $200 billion for the tariffs, in addition, we'd still be running $1.8 trillion, you know, deficits per year. And so I think we've got to slow down government spending. You don't even have to cut it a lot. You can just increase it slower and put in more pro-growth measures like making permanent the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the deregulation that's going on. And then also, too, Lars, the making permanent of the full expensing for investments. That way you can write off your investments as soon as you get it and not depreciate it over time. That will also substantially increase investment. And so I'm excited about those things. We have more economic growth, slow down the growth of spending, and I think we could balance the budget in about 4 or 5 years.
You know what I worry about, Vance? I worry that a lot of this stuff goes past the average person who says, okay, you talk about immediate expensing. It sounds like something you learn in accounting school. I always think of the gal or guy, the guy who runs a small auto body shop, and he hears those things. Does he understand this means when you go down and buy new diagnostic tools, the ones you've always wanted, because this year was a very good year and you made a big profit. Yep. You had a lot of customers. You did a lot of repairs. You can go buy that new diagnostic, you know, the stuff they plug into your car to figure out what's wrong with it. You go, how can I buy it? You write it all off against this year's profits. Oh, I thought I had to take 5 years to get the money back. No,
yeah.
No. Go out and buy the new gear and imagine how much his business or the lady who's got an eBay business who thinks, I'm using this old, you know, steam powered laptop computer. I'd love to get a new one. Oh, well, did you have a good year this year? Okay. Instead of giving it to the IRS, buy yourself a new laptop and write it all off this year. And she can understand that. The new laptop that costs her $1,500 or whatever it costs, I think that was the price I paid for the last one I had to buy. She says, I can take all that off this year's profits. Yep, Uncle Sam will help you pay for that laptop computer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Those bigger investments that you want to make to grow your business may even allow for, and now you can do buildings as well, which will help you to expand your small business into a little bit bigger and then a little bit bigger, and then you can hire more workers. And so what this is really doing is reducing your cost up front instead of trying to, you know, streamline it or have it averaged out over a couple of number of years. And so this is a great shot in the arm to investment in our economy. And I think that was probably one of the most pro-growth policies that was in the One Big Beautiful Bill.
Yeah, and what I worry, and or the person who says, I had a really good year this year, but if I buy all that new equipment this year, is next year, and the second and third and fourth and fifth, are they going to be as good? I don't know. But if you could get it all back in 1 year in tax savings, and really, that's not Uncle Sam buying her the laptop computer or the mechanic getting his new diagnostic tools. That's using your money because the government lets you keep more of it. That is Vance Ginn, former chief economist of the Office of Management and Budget, now at Ginn Economics. Back in a moment. It's First Amendment Friday, 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Donald Trump with a warning to Hamas at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference.
If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of yours.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. Apparently, some of the new inmates at Alligator Alcatraz down in Florida, they're not happy. They say the place is not fun to live at. And I'm not joking here. They've actually, family members are out saying they have some toilets that don't flush from time to time. They say the temperature has gone from freezing to sweltering. They said they have had to go to the hospital, that there are giant bugs down there in that part of Florida. And they say they don't have easy access to showers and toothbrushes or confidential calls with their attorneys. Well, I tell you what. I don't want Alligator Alcatraz to be a pleasant place to stay. I want it to be as unpleasant as it can constitutionally and legally, because I want it to be a reminder that people should not come into the United States illegally. And if they do, the return to their home country may be a little bit difficult. Let's go to Diane on First Amendment Friday. Hey, Diane, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Okay, thank you, Lars. Today, I'm not a naysayer, and I'm not addressing any of the political stuff. My husband had to drive me to Corvallis this morning for a medical appointment, and I'm just looking at my phone in the car, and a story came up about Governor Kotek. I had to read it four times to make sure it wasn't a joke. Supposedly, she is asking our legislature that unauthorized splashing on our Oregon rivers will cause a $500 fine.
Diane, one of the reasons I wanted to take your call, it'll give me a chance to debunk this one, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Here's what's happened. There are people who are reposting things from a kind of a, it's like the Babylon Bee, but not nearly as funny, and it's called That Oregon Life. I have no connection to them. I don't even know who's behind the site. But it is labeled on it as satire. And the headline on the story you're talking about, because I had seen the story myself, and I thought, I know that's satire. And I looked, and sure enough, it was. Okay. Tina Kotek announces $500 fine for unauthorized splashing on Oregon rivers. It also said you could buy a permit for $49.99 to allow you to do splashing in authorized areas only. It is a piece of satire, and that's all it is. So you just always it does. And so I wanted to use this as an opportunity to tell people, when you see stuff there, I will tell you, Diane, on an almost daily basis, I will read things and think that can't possibly be true. And then I find out it is true. I mean, there's crazy stuff going on in the world right now, but watch for the satire. The people who put it together, I'm sure, being as funny as they possibly can be. They're not quite Babylon Bee yet, but it is just a satire site. And that's all. Let's go to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Two things. One is I was wondering if you can confirm this or deny it, but I read somewhere that for every dollar increase in tax revenue, there's a $1.24 increase in spending. So if that's the case, you'll never tax your way out of debt, obviously. And
well, but hold on. Those are not necessarily linked together. You understand that, right?
No, that's why I'm asking. That's why I'm
Well, there is no legal link between spending and revenue, period. So, but have you ever met a person who every time he gets a raise, he still spends more money than he takes in?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Yeah, we all have friends. I mean, at one point I did it. I did it because I'd taken a job at a dramatically lower rate of pay years ago to move from radio to television. Did that for about 20 years, came back. But, you know, there are people who swear they make $50,000 a year now, but they spend $70,000 and they're running themselves into debt. And they say, if only I could make $75,000 a year, I could live within my means. And then they get to $75,000 and they spend $90,000. And when they get to $200,000, they'll spend $225,000. You know, the government is like that. If you give the government a dollar, they will probably increase spending or not reduce it. And so there's some truth to that, but they're not necessarily tied together you know, legally or constitutionally. It doesn't say if the government gets a dollar, they have to spend a buck and a quarter. But
No, I understand that. Yeah. I understand that. It just, I'm saying that's the reality is that for every of a dollar.
But it doesn't have to. Do you know that there are states in America that take in more revenue than they spend? I know that's unbelievable, and they have surpluses. And in fact, there are cities, Portland is one of the worst, because Portland has I think the debt works out that if they wanted to pay off what they owe right now, they'd have to charge every one of their residents the regular taxes you pay, plus about, I think it's $8,000 or $9,000. But do you know there are cities in America where if they settle up the books and said, we're going out of business, they'd pay every single citizen a bonus? They'd say, we've got an extra $2,000 per citizen sitting in our accounts because we don't spend more than we take in. We spend less. So when people tell you...
Well, that's certainly the exception, though.
Well, they are, but only because two things. One, citizens tolerate that kind of crap. So if your kid comes to you, Donald, if you've got kids, or Jeff, and the kid says, hey, Dad, I'm short of cash. You go, you were short of cash last month. I helped you out then. And you go, yeah, now I'm short of cash again. What do you suppose is going to happen when every time he's short of cash, you bail him out?
Yeah, well, I get it. And you know what? The thing is, too, is that the government doesn't have any way of increasing revenue except for the two.
Yes, they do.
Taxes.
Yes, they do. And Jeff, listen to the interview we did at 12:30 today where the BLM in Oregon could log 350 million board feet of timber a year, and they're only logging 250. If your kid comes to you and says, Dad, I could have worked 40 hours last week, but I only worked 20.